Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Folklore, which is one of the many podcast channels you can find on the New Books Network. I'm Rachel Hopkin, and today the book we'll be hearing about is called Rhythms of Revolt, European Traditions and Memories of Social Conflict in Oral Culture. This is a collection of essays co-edited by three folklore-friendly, for the want of a better term, historians, Eva Guillorel, David Hopkin, and William G. Pooley. As long-time listeners to this podcast may remember, David Hopkin is my brother, and he was interviewed on this podcast a couple of years ago. But today, my guest is Eva Guillorel. Eva, welcome to New Books in Folklore.
Hello.
I wonder if you could start by telling us a little bit about yourself and perhaps how you came to be a folklore-friendly historian, if you accept that that's what you are.
Yes, I accept this very well. In fact, I identify first as a social and cultural historian and mainly an early modern historian. So in France, it means people working on the 15th to 18th century history. But for me, the fields of history and folklore are very closely related. And I feel really at the intersection between the two disciplines, so between the sources, interests, and methods of folklorists and historians. But maybe I should say that the term folklorist is impossible to use in France today because the term is very negatively connotated and associated to the use and promotion of folklore in France during the Second World War by the collaborationist government. So after the war, everybody stopped using the word. So today, there is no department of folklore in France anymore, in French universities. I mean, there are departments of ethnology, of anthropology, but it would sound very weird to claim to be a folklorist today in France. But personally, I really feel comfortable with the sources and interests developed by folklorists in the 19th century and after.
And how did you become familiar with the methodology of the folklore discipline? Because it's not so common for historians to use that kind of working method.
I think the starting point was when I was 18 years old and I decided to record the life of my grandfather, who was born in Brittany in the countryside in a poor family. He left home at the age of 13. He spent a decade in the French Navy. And after the war, he moved to Paris to work in car factories, like many, many Breton people who immigrated to the capital city at that time. And I can't really remember how I started this life story recording, but it lasted during several years with regular sessions of recordings. And when we stopped, my grandfather was nearly 90 years old. He died shortly after. And this experience completely changed my relation with him. And I think it also completely changed my life in the way that I realized that I enjoyed very much talking to old people, talking about their lives, their stories, talking about oral traditions. And after that, I continued to do field work, mainly to record songs in Brittany and after that in French-speaking North America. So at the time, I was not aware I was doing ethnography or folklore or history or anything. I had no plan to make something professional with that. But I have been very lucky to meet academic people who pushed me in that direction. And so I started my studies, my academic studies after that, and I made 3 master's degrees in Brittany, one in history, one in Breton and Celtic languages, and one later in ethnology. And I had to find a topic for my master's degree in history and then my PhD in history. And I wanted to find a link between history, Breton, and ethnology. So all of these things I was passionate about. And I was also an amateur musician. I played the Renaissance lute and the Celtic harp, and I'm also an amateur singer. So I tried to find a link between all that, and I was very lucky to find a history supervisor who pushed me to work on historical folk ballads in Breton as a source to document early modern Brittany, so 16th, 17th, 18th century Brittany. And with this topic, it was a way to make a link between these different disciplines. So that's how everything started. And after my PhD, I spent 3 years in the US and Quebec for postdoctoral research. And then I got a job as an associate professor in Normandy in France in early modern history. And that's how I managed to live professionally of my passion for folklore and folk songs. But at the beginning, there was nothing planned, and I had never thought I would become an academic historian one day. So that's the story.
So tell us, what is Rhythms of Revolt about?
The book focuses on the memory of European revolts and social conflicts from the 15th to the beginning of the 19th centuries in oral tradition. So it's a book based on ethnographical sources like songs, legends, tales. And we had this idea that we wanted to work on the culture of rebels in the early modern period. And with the idea that this culture was primarily an oral culture, which was rarely recorded or written down. And many, many works have been written by historians about European revolts, but without having a serious look at oral testimonies, and especially testimonies that have been preserved and transmitted in oral traditions and collected by folklorists. And the project of the book was to try to re-evaluate these oral traditions as sources for studying early modern rebellions and the memory of these rebellions. Because, in fact, there is a lack of interest very often by historians and a conscious rejection of the value of folklore by the historical disciplines. It's the history of the disciplines which is related to that, because the historical discipline is rooted in historical methods since the end of the 19th century, when history diverged from folklore and established itself as a modern academic discipline based on the analysis of exclusively written documents, which were supposedly more faithful, more reliable than oral sources. It's a very debatable point. And so our project was to work on these oral traditions, often underestimated by historians. That was the purpose of the book.
Right. So it seems to me it's not just about these revolts and how they're portrayed in oral traditions, but also it's a kind of a manifesto to other historians to look at these oral sources in their own work.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think the word manifesto is a good one. And in a way, it's also a manifesto because very few historians are interested in such sources. So when you want to prove that these sources are interested, you must be proactive to convince other people that yes, it's worth investigating such sources. So yes, we had to be convincing, or try to be convincing, to convince historians used to work on written documents.
Right. And this is a lot of what the introduction is about. And because this is a volume that contains many different essays by many different authors, we're going to focus more on this introduction. So in the opening of the introduction, you're talking about the decision to use the word tradition rather than memory. Can you tell me a little bit about how that came about?
Yeah, in fact, we wanted to start the introduction with a discussion about vocabulary. and terms very often used by researchers, because when you see the recent works and studies made by historians or other researchers in the recent decade, the word memory is very, very often used, the word collective memory, social memory, past memory, and so on. And so this word has been used with very flexible meanings. And at the end, we don't always know anymore what it refers to. And that's why we wanted to propose another word, the word tradition rather than memory. When we talk about stories which continue to be passed on from generation to generation, although there is no personal connection anymore between the people who transmit these stories and the events they relate, when nobody knows where the stories come from, for example, if it's not the story of your own grandfather who experienced the Second World War, so a family story, perhaps it continues all the same to be transmitted. You don't know where it comes from, but still, and this is a tradition. And we also prefer the word tradition because the word memory is associated to expressions very often used by historians in the recent decades, like sites of memory, lieux de mémoire in French, following Pierre Nora's monumental collective book, Les lieux de mémoire, or another very famous expression, invention of tradition, following Eric Hobsbawm and Terence Ranger. So these two books have been very influential, and these historians have developed the idea that the transmission of memory is necessarily related to institutionalization, and they don't really believe that oral traditions can circulate in private, in families, without having been invented by external agents for political reasons or ideological purposes. And of course, the states, churches, schools, written books, other media have influenced oral tradition. We don't deny that. But historians used to work with written documents rather than with oral tradition often don't imagine that there are other models of creation, circulation, and influences. And that's why we wanted to focus on these alternative sources, oral traditions, and we wanted to discuss the words and the methods to work on these sources.
So the book is about revolts. It's using oral sources to look at various revolts that took place in early modern Europe. Is there a particular value for oral sources in the history of revolts? Why would oral sources be particularly valuable in researching revolts rather than, I don't know, succession of kings and queens or something?
I think they are very relevant because revolts are a field in which it's difficult to find sources emanating from the rebels because if we want to investigate rebels' motivations, their practices, their organization, we don't have many sources. The sources we have are written sources, and the culture of rebels was first and foremost an oral culture, so a culture expressed in a repertoire of ballads, of jokes, of prophecies, of legends, and of songs. Songs especially are very efficient media to spread rebellious ideas. And so the authorities were worried and frightened by the effect of songs on public opinion, and they tried to forbid them. And so when historians want to recover the culture, the voices of early modern rebels, what they have mainly it's official records of the forces of order denouncing them, like trials or police reports. And so many historians have worked on that with very interesting studies, but very few historians have tried to cite the words of rebels preserved in oral tradition. And, well, of course, when we talk about oral sources, oral tradition, we must also talk about their interaction with written text. We don't want to divide too much the oral and written things. Both things are mixed. We know that things are more complicated than what Romantic scholars in the 19th century said. So imagining that oral tradition was uncontaminated by other forms of historical knowledge. But, well, still we think that these oral sources have something to give us, to help us to know better the culture of these rebels. So maybe it's not an alternative history, but at least it's a supplementary history or a corrective to existing narrative and official accounts that we already have through a written form.
Okay, so say you wanted to research a revolt or rebellion that took place in, I don't know, 16th century France. Where would you go to find a record of the oral culture that was produced at that time and presumably continued to be passed down?
Yeah, we have different sources. So mainly, so you can try to find information in trials or administrative reports written down in the 16th century or 17th or 18th century. But we wanted to focus on ethnographical sources. So either songs or stories or legends written down by folklorists in the 19th century. So it's also written sources, but written sources taken, written down from oral tradition. Or there are also sound recordings made later, so in during the 20th century. And some of these songs, in certain cases, can still be heard today's songs or stories or legends, and so they can continue to be recorded and analyzed nowadays. So that's the different kinds of sources we have for oral traditions.
Okay, so you're actually using collections made of songs that recount events that took place centuries earlier, but which were recorded much later in one form or another.
That's right, exactly.
One of the sections in the introduction is called Keeping Quiet About Sedition, Silences in the Oral Archive. So there are obviously revolts and rebellions about which there are not collections recorded in some way. You have various theories about why there might be these silences in the archive, in the oral archive. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, in fact, at the starting point of our reflection, we thought that we would find more things than what we did. So we were a bit disappointed. I don't know if it's the right word, but we try to understand why for some revolts we have many sources from oral traditions and for others we don't have. For example, the Jacobite rebellions in the British Isles in the 17th, 18th century, or the Cossack uprising in Russia in the 17th, 18th centuries. We have many sources, many oral traditions, songs, legends. And for others, we don't have traces of oral tradition related to them. So the question is why? Does it mean that these traditions don't exist, which is a possibility? Or perhaps these traditions have not been transmitted until us, so they have been lost because they have never been recorded by ethnographers, or because they were transmitted during a few generations, and after that they lost their meaning, and so they stopped to be transmitted. And if they have not been transmitted until us, or if they have not been recorded by ethnographers, these traditions remain unknown to historians, so there is nothing we can do. But in some cases, it's also because historians and other researchers did not look at these traditions. So if we want to have sources, we need to have someone at some point interested in recording these sources. If it's not the case, maybe for some revolts, there are traditions, but we don't know them.
So what you're looking at is traditions that have been passed down through generations so that the memory of these revolts survives in the oral culture long after the events have passed. But it sounds like in some cases, it's not just that they haven't been recorded, but they weren't passed down in a significant way to begin with. it seems like you're hypothesizing that may have taken place in certain cases. For example, you discuss, why are there not many songs about the enclosures which took place in Britain? I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what the enclosures were and why you think there may not have been songs surviving from that period.
Yeah, it's a good question, because so enclosures, it's this phenomenon of enclosing common lands, so lands used by all the community to have something private. So rich people wanted to keep the land for themselves, for their personal use. And because of that, other people, mainly poor people, could not have access to this common land. And so it created inequality between the population. So this phenomenon of enclosure was very important in England, for example, since the end of the Middle Ages until the end of the early modern period. And so it was a form of traumatism to have these common lands taken away from the population. So we could imagine that this phenomenon of enclosure gave way to a lot of stories, of songs, of legends, but we don't find anything or almost anything. So the question is, did people make songs and we don't have them? Or perhaps, I say songs, it can be stories or legends, or perhaps they decided to keep silent and because it was too difficult to talk about such things, which is also a phenomenon analyzed by some researcher in psychology, for example, for very traumatic events, or perhaps the stories they made, or the stories, the songs they made, were not explicit, and we don't have a clue today to understand these stories and to understand the allusions of these stories of legend or legends to the enclosures. So we don't know today as historians how to interpret certain stories or certain allusions to these events. But all these are hypotheses. It's difficult to know, of course.
And actually, your next section in the introduction is precisely about the problem of interpreting oral traditions. And this is not only because we are now far removed from the events described in the traditions, but also because often these songs and stories have been recorded without sufficient contextual information. For example, we don't necessarily know who was singing to whom or anything about the context in which these oral traditions were performed. That's part of the problem, isn't it, in terms of how to interpret what's going on?
Yeah, it's a big problem, because very often the text we have, oral cultural texts we have, are fragmentary or unfinished, or they seem unfinished for historians today. And many things are suggested, but are not explicitly said. And especially in the case of revolts, sometimes keeping silent or using metaphors could be vital to escape repression and death. So especially with this topic of revolts, we can have things implicit but not explicit. And for songs, the rebellious message may lay not in the words, but in the tune, in just the melody. And the reuse of certain tunes can have seditious connotations. It's very common. A very famous one is La Marseillaise, for example, the French national anthem. It was composed during the French Revolution, but it was reused in many, many later revolutions in the 19th and 20th century. And just the fact to use this tune means, oh, I'm going to make a song which has a rebellious meaning. So in some cases, we have a clue to understand that. In other cases, we don't, or we can just make hypotheses. The problem to work on the early modern period is that we have very little information about the context, about the performers, about the performance. For example, we don't know which gestures accompanied the performance. And so without this contextual information, we can only speculate on what was being communicated to whom, for which purpose, and where the message was rebellious or was not.
There's a sentence in the introduction where you write, "Mutability of meaning is an unsettling trait, and it goes some way to explain why oral cultural sources have been neglected, even disdained by historians." And yet you're arguing in their favor. So even despite these problems, you're saying that they are worth looking at. So why? What can we find out from a song recorded even without context? Can you give us an example, perhaps, of a song that's been particularly useful in guiding an interpretation or offering an interpretation that might not otherwise have been available?
I would say first that the multiple meanings are an important part of the definition of this oral tradition. The plurality of interpretations according to the performer, the context, the audience. And that's also perhaps why these oral traditions are so powerful and why they continue to be transmitted from one generation to another, because different people could find a different meaning in them. Even when the first meaning, the first historical context is lost, some legends or stories or songs or prophecies can still have a powerful meaning for people continuing to hearing them and transmitting them. To take an example of a song which is not easy to interpret when we read the text. For example, the song El Segadors, sung during the revolt of Catalonia in the 1640s, so in Spain. And now it's the national anthem of Catalonia. And when you read the text, it's first a working song celebrating agricultural works, celebrating the strength of reapers working in the fields. And it's because of the use of this song in a rebellious context and the reuse of these songs in later rebellions that the song took a connotation, a seditious connotation, and it became a song of revolt, a song of rebellions. I don't know if it's the kind of example you wanted.
Yes, absolutely. So even though the words seem fairly innocuous, it's the history of how it's been used and the knowledge about that that's been passed on that has added this kind of seditious meaning to it.
Yes, exactly.
That's a great example. The next section, you're talking about the aesthetics of memory. And here you're talking a little bit about how the forms of oral culture, in order to survive, in order to remain popular, sometimes I think you describe how individual details are flattened out in a way, so they are less specific, but lend themselves to later reuse. Have I got that right?
Yes. In fact, there is a kind of a tension in oral tradition between stability and variation. Some things remain the same and other things change. And if you want an oral tradition to survive on the long term, it must be repeated and repeated again across generations. And there are mechanisms through which experience and events turned into a song or a legend are transformed into something memorable. And some folklorists have even defined kinds of aesthetic laws and stereotypes, for example, the law of tripling, the fact that things come often in threes, three things in stories, three girls, three kings, and so on. So you have certain stereotypes, certain cliches, which come back regularly. And when you are a historian, the question is, if there are stereotypes in these stories, in these songs, stereotypes that are common to a large repertoire of oral traditions, how could these traditions inform on historical precise events in the same time? And it could seem contradictory, but it's not. And in fact, historicism often matters in oral cultures, and many oral cultures put a high value on historical veracity. They prize fidelity to the narrative, so you must transmit a narrative as it has been heard from the previous generation. So innovation is not something interesting, well, something valuable. It doesn't mean, of course, that there are no alteration or no innovation. Of course, there are plenty of renewal of alteration. But still, even when they are reconstructed, many songs, stories, legends retain historical and also literary interest. So this is this tension between the two things. If you want, I could take perhaps practical examples to be clearer. I'm going to talk about Brittany because it's a place I know well, and I worked mostly on Breton songs. In Brittany, we are very lucky. So in Western France, we are very lucky to have a very rich repertoire of historical folk ballads. So in Breton, which is a Celtic language, and these songs, many of them talk about local historical events that took place in the 16th, 17th, 18th century. And these songs were recorded from oral traditions and are still, for some of them, heard today. And they were massively recorded in the second half of the 20th century, so centuries after the events took place. And they have kept, they have retained very precise details about these historical local events dating back from centuries before. So a lot of precisions on social, material, religious, cultural life. And so even though there are some cliché narrative stereotypes, motifs coming back, but in the same time, if we can make the difference between general stereotypes and original precisions related to an original historical event, they are very precious material to document the whole early modern Breton society.
Right, okay. The next section is talking about the meanings and uses of oral traditions in performances. And this covers something that you've already alluded to with the example you gave of the Catalonian national anthem, which is how oral traditions from a previous revolt can impact an oral tradition in a later revolt.
The idea that if songs or narrative were preserved in oral tradition, we can assume that it's because they kept a meaning for those who transmitted them. Even if this meaning is not historical anymore, it can be an aesthetic meaning, it's a literary meaning, but it can also be a story or a song which reminds lessons from the past and which can be motors of actions in the present and guides for the future. For example, if you take the case of prophecies are formed a huge repertoire of motifs, and these motifs can be reused to serve political ambitions. If we take, for example, legends about Owain Glyndwr. Owain Glyndwr was the last significant Welsh rebel leader against the English at the beginning of the 15th century. And before him, prophecies circulated, and he used these prophecies to inscribe his own actions in this prophetic tradition, in this living prophetic tradition, to encourage the insurrection. And so, like that, old prophecies were used again as motors for new rebellions. So that's something very important. And with this phenomenon, some traditions can keep a meaning, can stay alive following different centuries.
Okay, so this is sounding a little bit like what I've heard in the context of legends, ostension. Is that a term that you're familiar with? When people act in a way that's influenced by a legend that they've heard. You hear this particularly about urban legends where teenagers go legend tripping to the site of something they've heard about in an urban legend. But it sounds like you're talking about something similar going on with prophecies, whereby there exists a prophecy and someone like Owen Glyndwr uses that prophecy and acts in alignment with that prophecy to increase his appeal.
It's completely right. For example, there were many prophecies saying that in Ireland or in Wales, saying that the savior would come from the sea. And so some leaders changed their plans to effectively land from the sea to fit with the prophecy. So yes, you're right.
Okay, that's fascinating. Now, the penultimate section of the introduction is about sources for rethinking the early modern. And it begins with a sentence, "Our argument, therefore, is that oral traditions about early modern social conflicts are sources, difficult but rewarding sources, both for the early modern period itself and for the later periods in which they were collected. They have something to say to both early modernists and modernists." So tell me a little bit about that, because that sounds like it's a reflection on who did the collecting when.
Yes, it's also a reflection on historiography and debates developed by historians about periodization. So when does modernity start in European society? And it's a very difficult question. And for many historians, especially historians working on French history, these historians had debates about the role of rebellions by opposition to revolutions to define the difference between early modern and modern societies. And rebellion has often been seen as one of the defining features of the early modern period by opposition to revolution. So according to these French historians or historians working on French history, the early modern gave way to the modern when rebellion gave way to the revolution, with the emergence of mass organization, class conflict. So it was mainly Marxist historians defending this idea. And the idea is that early modern rebels wanted to restore a golden age with right social relations, but they did not necessarily contest hierarchy. Whereas during revolutions, the aim was to destroy the social order and to create a new society. So that's why for French historians, the early modern period finishes with the French Revolution in 1789. But if we consider oral traditions, the chronological divisions become fuzzy. There is no clear distinction between past and present, because these stories, these songs, these old slogans were reused and revivified through their repetition in oral tradition. It's what we said earlier. And so there is a confusion between the old languages of rebellion and more radical languages of revolution. So finally, this mechanism of oral tradition with these repetition, renewals, transformations from generation to generation transcends the usual chronologies used by historians. And because traditions use metaphors and allusions, as we said, they may have a plurality of meanings, of interpretations, and so everyone can interpret them as they want. So they can be simultaneously conservative and radical and have some things taken from the early modern and things taken from the modern. So that was more or less the idea we wanted to develop in this section.
Okay. So that pretty much brings us to the end of the introduction. There's just a final section encouraging people to look for sources, I think. Is there anything else you want to say about the introduction?
Perhaps I wanted to say that with David, what we would like, and that's why I think the word manifesto you used was a good one, we would be very happy if more historians, many more historians and researchers, having we hope, the same conviction as we have, of perhaps having been convinced by this introduction, will continue to work on these songs, on these oral traditions, on these legends, with the idea that there are many, many more studies to be done based on this material. There are thousands and thousands of oral traditions which have never been published since they were collected, which are still in manuscripts, in local libraries, which are still on sound recordings. So many things to do. And we are also convinced that some other sources could still be collected on the field. So even today in the 21st century, so there are a huge repertoire of underused oral sources that remain to be found and remain to be investigated. So really our hope is that we are not the only people to think that, and that many other historians and researchers will be convinced by this idea and look seriously at these oral sources.
I hope so too. Now, there's then all these case studies, I think 13 different case studies, which provide the chapters which follow. Do you want to tell us about maybe one or two of them?
Yes, perhaps I will start with a French case from the south of France. There is a chapter written by Philippe Joutard, who is a leading historian in France, who is now 85, so not a young researcher anymore, but an influential researcher that we really wanted to have in our team, because he was one of the first historians in France interested in oral traditions related to what we call the revolt of Camisards. So Camisards, it's at the beginning of the 18th century in the Cévennes, so in the south of France. It's people who were fighting against the repressive religious policy of King Louis the 14th. So they were Protestants. And Philippe Joutard made his PhD in the 1960s on these people. His idea was to work on written sources, as all historians did at the time. But he went on the field, and the more he went on the field, the more he heard stories spontaneously told by the people. And he realized that hundreds of legends were circulating about these peasants having fought against the king at the beginning of the 18th century. So he started to record these songs, but very few songs, these legends. And these legends continued to be transmitted until now. It's still very present in families now. Well, after the second half of the 20th century, it's more complicated to talk about the circulation of oral tradition, because there are so many different media now, internet, TV, and so on. But still, since the 18th century until the present day, and he worked on the different sources having influenced these oral traditions of written sources, iconography, oral things, and he really made a fantastic and pioneering study on this Camisard. It's also interesting because he made, in the book, Philippe Joutard made a parallel between the Camisard and the Covenanters, so people, rebels in Scotland. And he made this parallel because Stevenson, the novelist, went to France and wrote a book, a diary on his travel in France, in which he wrote down in the 19th century many comments, many legends on these French Protestants, comparing them with the situation in Scotland. So this is a very interesting chapter, in my opinion. For a completely different chapter and topic, we could talk about the chapter written by Malte Grisse, who is a German scholar specializing on Russian history. And he wrote a chapter on songs and legends about early modern revolts in Russia in the 17th and 18th century around two charismatic leaders, Stenka Radzin and Emilian Pugachev, who were Cossack leaders who had made rebellions against the central power. And many, many oral traditions were collected from the 19th century onwards until the present date. We have sources written down. We have oral recordings of these songs. And this interesting thing is that Stenka Radzin's rebellion was in the 17th century. Pugachev's rebellion was one century after. But the same motifs, the same stories were reused. So several generations after, taken from the first rebellion and reused for the new rebellion. So we were talking about how our traditions could be motors of action, how they could be reused in later rebellions. And this is an interesting case here in Russia.
Fantastic. Now you've got the conclusion to the book is not written by any of the editors. So the editors are yourself, my brother, David Hopkin, and William Pooley. The conclusion is written by somebody else, Peter Burke. What does Peter Burke say in the conclusion?
Yeah, Peter Burke was a bit like Philippe Joutard. We really wanted to have him in our team because he was a pioneering historian working on popular cultures in early modern Europe and interested in folklore. And so we asked him to come to both workshops. He did not give any paper, but he proposed conclusions, and we kept these conclusions for the book. And in fact, in the conclusion, he comments the historiography of revolts and memory studies and oral traditions, and he proposes three key terms, especially relevant, I think, to work on oral tradition and on the memory of revolts. And these three key terms are, the first one is re-employment, so the adaptation of old stories to new events. The second word is re-enactment, so closely related to the notion of performance, how new revolts are in fact re-enactment of older revolts. And the last word is reconstruction, so the idea is that the memories of new revolts are gradually reconstructed in oral traditions to fit traditional models. And I think that with these three words and the comments he made and these three words, he put together many of the elements of the discussions, of the arguments developed in the different chapters and in the conclusion. So we are very happy to have this conclusion in the book.
Okay, that's great. So Eva Guillorel, we thank you so much for joining us on this New Books in Folklore podcast. And just to remind listeners that the New Books in Folklore podcast is just one of the many channels you can find on the New Books Network. So Eva, have a lovely rest of day.
Thank you very much.